Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. After their two-week fling in Paris, Jocko worked on the movie until Christmas rolled around and forced him to stop for a visit to his father in New York. His fling with Ryoko resumed in New York, then Jocko left after New Year's to finish the film. They traded occasional emails and speed messages, but without his smile, her hair, and their passion in the same room, their interactions grew more redundant and became less frequent. Ryoko slipped back into a bit of a work slump, and she started fishing for some way to expand or change her beat completely. In her time in Albany, she had created excellent working relationships with a range of top officials through a combination of questioning styles, hard-boiled attack when she felt patronized, and professional off-the-record commiseration with officials and staff members to build trust. Ryoko's approach brought her the respect of influential women in political circles. One of those was her most valuable contact, the press secretary for a prominent state senator. They were discussing a new bill about food stamps when the secretary said, "We know that because we're women, but men have a different view." A light bulb went off in Ryoko's head. She could formulate a weekly news roundup called A Woman's Views on News. It harkened back to her mentor's experience and her charge to Ryoko to change the world. Ryoko would work on the format and pitch it to the station. While the idea was ruminating, an acquaintance at the gym suggested Ryoko talk to a guy she had met at a party who did something she thought sounded important with computers. Ryoko got an okay from her editor to work up a short segment. Driving in the 200-year-old industrial city of Troy, New York, felt odd to Ryoko after spending so much time in Albany. It was just across the river, but the blue-collar neighbor was without the posturing and monuments of the nearby state capital. Ryoko was driving the latest in a string of Toyotas that her father regularly handed down when he got his new company car. The Camry took the steep climb from the Hudson up to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute without a groan, and Ryoko followed the GPS instructions to the cafe whose name Krishna Anand had sent via speed message. Krishna had sent Ryoko an introductory fact sheet that sounded like it had been cobbled from a business proposal and a PhD dissertation. She had no clue what his product did, other than having something to do with TV and web page comments. "Do you cover a lot of tech?" Krishna asked after setting down a cappuccino with a heart drawn in the foam by a geeky student at the counter. "What?" she asked. Oh, technology. Well, no, I mean I cover the budget committee, and technology infrastructure is always a big debating point." "I see. Well, what can I tell you?" "Why don't you tell me what your invention does?" "Ha," he laughed respectfully. "You don't usually hear the word invention in software circles." Krishna noticed the smoothness of her skin and the way the soft parabolae of her cheeks arrived at her dark red lips. He almost missed her next question. He was so absorbed in the view. "Tell me what it is as though I'm an eighth grader. Although I guess when you were an eighth grader, you were probably doing calculus." "Actually, I was reciting the Bhagavad Gita 4 hours a day and cleaning my dad's hotel in a little village called Tumkur." "Really?" Ryoko filed this fact away in case she wanted to use it for color in her story. "I studied calculus in 9th grade. That's when Gurukula went to half a year." "So here I am, a typical American 8th grader. What does your, program do?" Ryoko was satisfied that the story was good enough for a 2-minute segment, maybe as part of a new technologies series. She worked it up with a bit of screen-captured video, some stock footage of TV viewers, and planned a brief interview with Krishna in the Albany Network studios. She wondered if doing the interview in his lab might make sense. When asked, Krishna balked, explaining that his lab was no bigger than a closet. Ryoko decided that putting him under studio lighting behind a desk would add credibility to his claims that the technology was potentially important. A good shot of his sincere face describing the product would be useful. He was very good-looking, and that was always helpful on television. The short news spot managed to pique some editorial interest, and Ryoko arranged with Krishna to do a more in-depth piece. Ryoko was crowded next to him in his tiny lab at RPI to see the system work. Krishna elaborated on his software, but kept interrupting himself, offering to order food, going to the cabinet to get her a drink, touching her arm, asking about her life, making jokes. They had been testing out the television commenting system for 3 hours when she realized that it was 10 o'clock. The evening had blurred by, Ryoko digitally bantering with Krishna over a dozen TV shows, watching, remarking, reading comments, counter-commenting, fighting over the remote, flipping to a new show, laughing, ordering sushi, drinking shots of Glenlivet from the bottle rather than the coffee mugs he had available, debating barware aesthetics in a scroll over a network news recap about weather, thrilling to the improvisational possibilities of writing on the fly with someone smiling at everything she expressed into the voice to digital, extending her hand, accepting his hug in return with a giggle. The hug lingered. Her scotch-induced euphoria pushed her towards something she might not have done otherwise. She leaned back without releasing the hug, then kissed his cheek. He stroked her hair from the top of her head, and when she did not object, he turned his head and kissed her on the mouth. She asked if he wanted to come to her place for a drink. He agreed without hesitation. The 15-minute ride back to Albany was silent in contrast to the hours of banter. She stole smiling glances at him as she drove. He gazed at her the whole way to her apartment. The man who could talk to dogs was accepted in the Cine Fondation student category at the Cannes Film Festival. Jaco wanted to phone Ryoko to tell her, but he hadn't talked to her for a few months. He was sure the spark was there waiting to reignite and finally dialed Ryoko from Łódź. Krishna had been staying often at Ryoko's and was there when she picked up the call. "Is someone there with you? I hear a man's voice," Jaco pressed her. "Well, yes, Jaco." She admitted that she had been seeing someone, as she hadn't really heard from him recently. Jaco began arguing that he had been busy but had kept in touch. Ryoko told him that she could do what she wanted. He shouted at her, and she hung up. Ryoko sat on her bed crying. "Who was that?" Krishna asked, sitting next to her on the bed. "Just a guy I went out with, a director in Paris." "Are you okay? Who is this guy?" Krishna asked, surprised that Ryoko could be so shaken when she always seemed so focused and sure. "I'm fine. It was just a surprise to hear from him. Go back to what you were working on." Ryoko always had an easy time with men. She didn't care that much about them. That is, they weren't a motivating force in her life the way they can be for women who are explicitly looking for marriage, family, status, etc. So when she found herself with two men whom she cared about, it was an odd experience. Hearing from Jaco felt really good, even though it ended badly. But she had her new boyfriend, Krishna Anand, in the apartment with her. She wanted to call Jaco back and apologize, to hear his voice again, laugh at his jokes, and delight in how much he cared for her. She was stuck, not between two hard places, but between two wonderful places. Her instinct was to try to have both. She realized, based on Jaco's reaction on the phone, that that was unlikely. The premiere of The Man Who Could Talk to Dogs was scheduled to take place in the Grand Palais in Cannes on the final night of the annual film festival. The contrast between the seedy student center in Łódź, where Jaco had screened the film for his classmates, and the opulence of the festival made the young director wonder if he was dreaming. His film had won the student film category and had garnered outstanding pre-buzz from jury members. Some members of the press were interested. He had an all-events pass, so he was enjoying the festival's films and parties all week before his film screened. The one distraction in the bliss of the experience was that the friends and family included in his week's entourage did not include Ryoko. She never replied to the apology he sent after blowing up at her on the phone. A week earlier, though, Ryoko was looking at his apology and the invitation to Jaco's premiere that he emailed. She had immediately called her editor to arrange for time off and booked a flight. Krishna exploded when he heard that she was going. His typical calm was replaced with a dark fear that Ryoko had never seen in him before. Normally, possessiveness would make her run from a relationship, but in Krishna, it was deeply enduring. She felt as if he might not survive her leaving. Krishna, don't worry, she comforted him. He's just a friend with an opening. He was unmoved. She gave a little more. How about I shorten the trip? I'll just go for the day to see the film. How about I go with you? He countered. She could not resist, given his obvious pain at the perceived rival, and while she was sure there would be challenge having Krishna there with Jocko, it did seem apropos. Krishna was the current boyfriend. She added him to her flight plans. The day before his film was to screen, Jocko ran into Ryoko and her boyfriend in a narrow street in the Vieille Ville.
Ryoko! Jocko, so good to see you. I'm so glad you're here. You didn't tell me you were coming.
I wasn't sure I could, Ryoko said. It had been months, but seeing his face brought her right back to their last days together. She was losing herself in Jocko's smile, but then Krishna cleared his throat and she pulled back.
Jocko, this is my boyfriend, Krishna Anand. Krishna, this is Jocko Jones, the director whose movie we're here to see.
I'm looking forward to seeing your film. Congratulations, Krishna added politely. Jocko was staring at Ryoko. It is so good to see you. He turned toward Krishna. We had such a good time when she was on vacation last year. After that verbal knife, he turned a knowing look toward Ryoko. He needed to get rid of Krishna, but he had to remember his manners or she might get upset, like on the phone.
What do you do, Krishna? He asked without taking his eyes off her.
I'm a software engineer. I created a tool that allows comments on TV.
I don't watch TV, Jocko said dismissively, and then changed the subject. Ryoko, I'm having a reception tomorrow before the film. I hope you can come.
Both of you, of course. The question was simple, but Ryoko felt a weight on the decision, as though her life and two others were held in the balance. Her answer was interrupted by a hubbub approaching around the tight corner of the cobblestone street. A dozen photographers were shouting as they trailed singer Blanche DuBois and two men dressed like matadors. As the mob pushed the triangle of lovers against the old town's building's ochre walls, Krishna followed the singer's departure with interest and then turned to Ryoko.
That's Blanche DuBois. I heard she's doing a concert at the festival. She's really good.
Jocko looked for Ryoko's reaction, and when she turned, he raised an eyebrow and mouthed, "Matadors." Ryoko laughed, and Jocko took that as a score. He grabbed her arm and strode off with her down the road. Krishna stood, startled, then hurried after them, feeling like a ditched schoolboy. He grabbed her other arm after he caught up, and the trio made their way back toward the hotels. Later in their room, Ryoko apologized to Krishna for what happened, but he said he realized Jocko took her, not the other way around. As he was getting dressed for the evening's events, though, he became depressed at the thought of another pissing match with Jocko and begged Ryoko to skip his reception. She feared getting further tempted by Jocko. She feared upsetting Krishna. The logical decision was to skip the reception and just go to the screening. Later, in the gold leaf and red velvet appointed breakout room in the Palais, Jocko was talking with his father. Archie came from New York with a handful of his own friends. They had arranged a 2-week group European vacation, with Jocko's screening as the highlight. A thunderous rumble came from the hallway outside. Loud shouting preceded Blanche DuBois crashing through the doorway. With a snap of fingers on both hands, she posted her two matadors on either side of the entrance. They stopped the throng of photographers like so many bulls. Blanche walked to the bar without looking back. Jocko crossed toward her, but before he reached the bar, she carried her drink to a nearby empty table and sat down. He went over and stood in front of the petite dynamo, whose dyed black hair and hippie fashion graced posters all over town, and said hello. "Who are you?" she asked without looking at him. "I'm the director this reception is for," he replied, smiling, his dimple indenting one cheek.
"Oh my God, I'm so sorry for crashing your reception." She looked at him, and his smile brought one out on her face. "I'm just so sick of the reporters and photographers. Well, you know."
"They're not very interested in my student film," Jocko said.
"Student film?" "Oh, not that dog movie."
"The Man Who Could Talk to Dogs, yes." Jocko was shocked that she knew about his film.
"I so wanted to see that, but I forgot to put it on my schedule. I heard it's stellar."
"Well, it's showing in 10 minutes if you still want to see it."
"No, yeah? Super.
As long as you don't let the press in."
"Well, I think that's kind of the point, right?"
She tilted her head down a little and looked up at him,
pouting lips contrasting with a smile in her eyes. She offered a compromise. Yeah, well, okay, but maybe my boys can keep out the paparazzi at least. Jocko couldn't believe she was going to watch his film. So you're going to stay? Cool, you'll have to let me know what you think. Of course. What's your name? Sorry, I forget. I can be a space cadet. Jocko Jones. She stood and moved toward him, reaching out her hand to shake his, but palmed down like a princess. Blanche Dubois, my real name, so you don't have to ask. Jocko kissed her hand, and she laughed and grabbed his arm and pulled close. You have a gorgeous smile, very Clark Gable. Hmm. Good to meet you, Jocko Jones. Now I'm glad I crashed your party. The pleasure is mine. Say, I have to go into the theater. He stepped away and bowed slightly. Well, you're going to watch your movie with me, right? Blanche said, as though they were teenagers awkwardly making a date. Well, sure, he said, as thrilled as a teenager who just got a date. He looked toward the screening room, and despite the excitement of a date with Blanche Dubois, he remembered the gravity of the event. The press was poised to start or end his career. He stared at the carpet. She touched his arm, and he came back. Sorry, I guess I'm a little nervous about the press and all. She gave him a slap on the shoulder. Hey! The press wants to like you. The buzz told them to. That's how it works with those morons. That's how I heard about it, too. So, hey, I guess it's not all bad. He mustered the bravado to stand up tall and hold out his arm, then said, let's go make history. That's the spirit, Jocko. Let's go kick some ass. She slapped his butt, then dragged him through the viewing room doors. As the closing credits began to roll, the audience applauded, hooted, and stood for the man who could talk to dogs. Jocko was sitting with Blanche in the front row, which she had insisted was the best place to view from. He quickly stood and bowed to the applause, but mostly looked for Ryoko, whom he spotted halfway back smiling at him. Blanche jumped out of her seat with exuberance that made her a concert phenomenon and nearly tackled him back into his seat with a barrage of compliments and raves. When he got stable enough to turn back around, the members of the audience who weren't ogling the director and the rock star had begun exiting, and Ryoko and Krishna were gone. Blanche would not let go of his arm. They made their way back to the reception room, where Jocko introduced her to his father and several of the film crew. Dozens of people were thanking him, exclaiming amazement. One was in tears. Jocko ate up the compliments, but had a raw longing for Ryoko. Where had she gone? Assuaging that discomfort, though, was a growing fascination with the alluring woman hanging on his arm, who was getting as much attention as he was. They said goodbye to everyone and headed out together. Joseph had to admit that the matadors were very helpful at clearing the way to the palais doors. Once on the street, camera flashes and shouts created a multi-sensual symphony. Blanche held up her program as a shield and kissed Jocko's cheek. Then she whispered in his ear, we can escape the paparazzi in my penthouse. Paris, another 2001. Joseph Jones sat in his hotel room in Paris on the evening of his mother's funeral and stared at the newspaper's page of Movie Times, looking for a distraction. He wished his father were there, but Archie had refused to come to see in death the woman who had left him for another in life. Joseph grew up with his father and went to art school in New York, but he had visited his mother and Rusty every summer until this year, when an internship at the Brooklyn Museum kept him away. Sitting there now, he pondered the nature of her fate, wondering whether his mother would still be here if he had been in Paris as he usually was. Would he have somehow changed things to keep her and Rusty from crashing into a tree in the countryside outside Paris? To distract himself from his feelings of loss, he went to the only movie showing near his hotel, which turned out to be Kieślowski's Blue. He was pulled in at the accident in the opening scene. The film felt as real as a dream. Afterwards, he sat in the window of an internet cafe thinking about why it was so powerful. Beyond the obvious similarity of the opening scene to his mother's accident, he had a deeper sense that this film held the key to something new for him. The Polish director had a more sensitive, slower aesthetic than he saw in mainstream movies he had scoffed at in the States. And in contrast with the Nouvelle Vague films Rusty had him watch, it expressed more likelihood for evolution or growth, more hope. He thought about his own art, how cool and abstract the gallery videos he had been making were compared to the raw emotion he had just experienced in the cinema. Suddenly, a wave of emotion took his breath away. He sat for a timeless moment without seeing what he was looking at, without thinking of anything. He woke slowly from the daydream and moved over to one of the computers in the internet cafe. He read everything he could find out about Kieślowski. Joseph looked at his watch. "Midnight," he said aloud, then did the math to see if his father would be awake. He went back to his hotel and dialed New York. "Dad," he said, "I want to go to film school in Poland." That fall, Joseph attended the Łódź Film Academy that had produced Krzysztof Kieślowski. He loved his classes, in spite of the challenge of missing the occasional joke in Polish from one of his teachers or classmates. The school had an international student body, though, so classes were usually taught in English or had a graduate assistant translating. Joseph was always one step ahead of his classmates. He chalked it up to his prior art school training. But his teachers called him a natural. By the time he reached his last year, he had met a lot of professionals in the small European art film community and got insights from them that complemented his formal training. He gained a boldness from those interactions, which often included compliments about his work or ideas. He also started to understand why some films succeeded while others languished. "C'est super," a French actress said when he shared his idea for a feature film on a road trip with a few friends he had met in Paris. The cameraman beside her agreed. It would make an excellent crossover film to appear both to art houses and big theaters. You have to do it. He thrilled Joseph by adding, "We can help if you want." With his friend's encouragement, Joseph bucked his dissertation advisor's recommendation that he shoot a short based on a Greek myth, and instead made and starred in the feature film, shot low budget on locations with actors he had met on trips to Paris, Prague, and Berlin. The film was about an art-loving drifter, played by Joseph, who can talk to dogs. The dogs, in addition to being duly interested in food and passing opportunities for sex, are able to tell him all kinds of useful information about the people that are around. The drifter uses his abilities to his advantage, first in insignificant ways, to find out about some food or garbage that contains something worth pawning for hotel money. One day, at the museum, he notices a painting by Andrea Mantegna. To his surprise, he hears the dog in the painting speaking to his master. What shocks the drifter as much is that the dog sounds like a New Yorker, and his master sounds like he's from Brooklyn. The conversation proceeds, with the dog explaining that he's not the same breed as in the original. But before he can get very far, the drifter cuts in. "How are you talking? You're a painting." The master informs the drifter that paintings can talk if the painter can capture the soul of the subject in the painting. The woman at his side quips, "You don't hear much these days because all the paintings are abstract," which brings laughter from the entire cast of the dinner table portrait. "But I've seen hundreds of paintings, and none of them talks," the drifter argues. The painting's matron explains, "Well, the idea of living forever is exciting at first, but after a while it gets boring being stuck in here. Souls check out after a year or so and move on to whatever comes next." Several of the family members yawn. One says he's about ready to check out and hopes he'll end up in a painting with a nude the next time around. "But this painting is from the 15th century. Why are you still talking?" The dog yips enthusiastically, then fills him in about a forger named Domingo in Brooklyn who does a whopping business in Renaissance-era fakes. The drifter uses his canine friends on and off canvas to help break up the forgery ring that has fooled dozens of private collectors and institutions on the continent. Joseph won the Cine Fondation Award for Best Student Film at Cannes for The Man Who Could Talk to Dogs. He met Blanche Dubois at the opening, and she helped him get a small European distribution deal. The film played the Film Forum in New York as part of the Cannes Festival program. Hollywood had been in a slump for almost 5 years when Silvio Mastroianni read a Village Voice blurb about the quirky, prize-winning movie whose young director was dating Blanche Dubois. Silvio was an acquisitions agent for a major Hollywood distributor. His assigned area was edgy films, which the company translated as weird spins on violence, new kinds of psychopaths, and kinky sex. Silvio had loads of family money, but he longed to be in the film industry and had taken the acquisitions job out of desperation to get a foot in the door of his chosen industry when all the appealing doors were bolted shut by the industry recession. It was a useless attempt, of no satisfaction to him or the company. He hated the kinds of movies he was supposed to bring in, and they hated everything he offered. Silvio saw The Man Who Could Talk to Dogs. He hesitated before sending a bye recommendation to his boss, but then conceded to himself that there was no future with this distributor, and this might be the straw that broke the camel's back. It did break the camel's back. His boss responded via email, "What are you thinking? Perhaps you'd be happier working elsewhere." In a moment of emptiness-fueled bravado, Silvio wrote to Joseph Jones. He was shocked that Jones liked his idea to distribute his films independently, starting with universities. The film was a smash in the U.S., first with stoned students, then with serious critics, then with everybody. Over the next 5 years, Not That Mastroianni Films became a new breed of film studio in which auteur, distributor, and investor were a team. Joseph Jones gained a reputation as a wunderkind of cinema.
That's it for today's excerpt. You can hear more later on in Peter's podcast. Or if you just can't wait, head over to Amazon.com where you can find Incarnation.